it's going to reach you. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves. Just a little bit of background as far as myself goes. All of you here know me to some degree. A lot of you knew me, you know, back growing up as a kid and stuff like that. And then at one point in time in my 20s, I took off to school. And then maybe I made this odd appearance here and there, but you didn't really know what was going on behind the scenes. So just a quick summary of what happened behind the scenes. I spent a few years, first of all, at Tyndale University College, where I did a four-year degree. It was a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy. From there, I pursued studies. I moved downtown Toronto to the University of Toronto. Associated with the University of Toronto is the Toronto School of Theology, which is an assortment of theological schools which have master's, graduate-level degrees, which are offered either in-house or in association with the University of Toronto. I went to Wycliffe College initially, where I did a Master of Arts in Religious Studies. And then I followed that up with a doctorate degree at Regis College in Philosophical Theology. So I had, throughout my whole academic career, I had sort of two main interests. One was biblical studies and the other one was philosophy. You can sort of see that the philosophy more or less won out. But, and you've probably got a taste of my desire, my enjoyment of biblical studies and, you know, recent sermons that I've done. But philosophy is kind of my area of, you know, that I studied the most in. And I enjoy. And when it comes to talking about this worldview question, I think that you need the perspective of multiple disciplines. Worldview and culture, it involves history, it involves philosophy, it involves theology, it involves comparative religions, it involves sociology, anthropology, science, you name it. Because that's what makes up a culture, all of that. And that's what makes up a worldview, all of that. And that's why I'm at a certain level not quite equipped to give this lecture, while at the same time, nobody is. You know, you can be a professor in history, and you know the history of movements and thoughts, but you specialize in one small area, you don't get the full perspective. So it's a contributive, collaborative effort to sort of understand what's going on in culture. And so remember that when you're even engaging media and you're sort of getting a pulse from the journalism and stuff like that, they're giving you a perspective. And, you know, the hope is that these lectures, we have two set up today and then 2 weeks from now, and the hope is to continue this ongoing. And there's so much material that could be covered, so many areas to explore. It's hard to know where to begin. And so I thought the place to begin, at least for the first 2 weeks, are the basics. Today's introductory. Today is, what is a worldview? What is culture? What do I mean by this title, Engaging Culture, a Biblical Worldview? What's a biblical worldview? What does it mean to engage culture? All those types of things we want to talk about today. And then next week, I wanted to move into specifically honing in on a biblical worldview. And hopefully as well, sort of giving an overview of opposed worldviews. When we talk about a culture which we live in, Western culture, we have a mixture, a pluralist mixture of worldviews coming together, groups of people with different backgrounds, religious and so forth, but at the same time, there almost is a bit of an overriding thread, a developing worldview that tries to encompass all of these worldviews, and it can't really do that without sort of suppressing some of them in order to have this dominant voice come through in the end. And so that's kind of the trajectory in which we are on, is to focus on what if we were to put our pulse, we've tried to feel the pulse of where culture is at today and where it's heading, you know, that is, if you can understand that, then you can sort of anticipate what's coming down the pike. And as a church here at Grace Bible Chapel, we can't be in this alone. You can't do it as an individual person to stand up against the woes of society and be a lone wolf, especially as more and more stuff keeps happening in the political circles, which and the influence of the academic elites and so forth, that you can't stand alone. And Christians are going to find themselves in a situation right now where the political winds are against them and the cultural winds are heavily against them. And we're in a situation is, what do I do? How do I engage? But the thing is we do better to engage as the body of Christ than to do as a bunch of individuals isolated from everybody else in society. So let's remember that. And this is exploratory. This is an exploratory series, hopefully, of classes that come down. And again, I want this to be interactive. I don't have all the answers, but we need to, you know, think about this, talk about this, and work this out. And we need to do this as well with outside of, you know, our small circle here with other people and start talking about it. I know at work, so I work at Heritage Timbercraft, which is for a Mennonite family. And so my first real exposure to people, to sort of a little bit of the Anabaptist culture and background. And they have a much stronger culture than most people do. We are very individualistic. Most churches in the evangelical tradition are extremely individualistic oriented, like our culture. They are not. I'll tell you right now, they are in a much better position in facing the woes of society than we are. That's just I'm just telling you right here and right now, they're in a better situation because they collaborate with each other. So anyways, this is, it'd be interesting to have, to be able to pull some of them in and engage in this discussion with us, because there's a lot we could learn from them. But anyways, let's continue on. I want to talk about some of the objectives that I do have. I've listed some. Anytime you get a syllabi, when you're starting a university course, you'll always have a list of objectives. So what is it the teacher's trying to impose on you, or something like that? Or what's the goal? What are we trying to accomplish? So we want to encourage one another to live lives faithful to Jesus Christ while discerning what in our present culture is consistent or inconsistent with our calling as Christians. Second, to develop an understanding of what a biblical worldview is and how it relates to other worldviews that inform contemporary Western society. So we're not focusing on all cultures everywhere or anything like that. We're focusing on our own situation, Western culture. That's not to say that what's going on elsewhere in the world isn't important. It is. But this is where we are right here and right now. And this is where we find ourselves. This is where we need to address important issues. Third, to equip Christians with an understanding of the history of events and development of ideas that have led to the cultural inheritance in which we presently live. So, you know, somebody's going to have to do some reading to, like, history. If you don't investigate it, you'll never know it. And if you don't know it, you're doomed to repeat the errors of the past and to be completely ignorant of what's coming down the pike in the future. So, next, to develop critical thinking skills so that we may better know how to critique, engage, and participate in culture so as to inform and transform in culture with Christian meanings and values. Next, to provide resources for Christians to help them to critically reflect on and present concrete ways to engage our culture. So as we move along here, I'm going to suggest some readings, some books and stuff like that, or articles that you may want to purchase and to read. And some of these materials will be ones that I'm using parts of and stuff like that to help us think in this. So some of the information will be coming out of those books. But anyways, we need to be thinkers. And to be thinkers, you have to be able to set aside some time to think. And you have to have the materials to help you along the way. So I'll do what I can to help provide what I can to, and what's available to me. And if you have some suggestions that I'd be quite willing to look into them and hopefully encouraging people to read them as well. Next, to establish networks within the local Christian community in light of current anticipated anti-Christian political, economic, and cultural trajectories. So we've already talked about that. To recognize that God is sovereign over all that takes place in the world. This does not entail complacency for us, but should motivate us to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ to the world, while knowing that God will use our faithfulness to bring about good in our society and culture. So it's easy to adopt a sense of fatalism. Yeah, there's nothing we can do. Just whatever. Let's get it over with, be done with, and let bygones be bygones and move on. That's not a Christian response. And so I hope that no one feels that they're at that point where it's just, I can't keep going like this or anything like that, but we need to encourage one another to remember that part of our faith is that God is sovereign. Nothing happens apart from his wisdom and his will. He's sovereign over what's going on in the world. He's sovereign over history, so let's keep that in mind. Next one is to develop Christian character so that we are not swept up by trends within the culture that would result in compromising or abandoning the faith, but to persist in living not by lies. So anybody here know anyone who was strong in the faith or at least grew up in the faith and has within short memory moved away from the faith? I can think back to our youth group years, all the youth that we had in the church. We had a big youth group back in the late 80s, early 90s. And it'd be kind of embarrassing to, you know, I hear about broken marriages. I hear about people who don't go to church anymore. And that's just discouraging to hear. So it's easy to get swept up in the political winds, the cultural winds of society. And if you're not equipped to respond to that, then you're probably, more probably than not, likely to give into that and go along with the trend, because nobody likes to be in the minority. And nobody likes to be called names and shamed in public. So this is what this is part of the problem which we live in. We would live in a woke culture, and the political winds are definitely, at this point in time, strongly against faithful biblical Christianity. So let's start off with the basics. So we're talking. So I have a couple key words in our title. One is culture, and the other is worldview. So what on earth are we talking about when we're talking about culture, and what are we talking about when we talk about worldview? Well, culture is the word culture as it's getting used today and as we'll be using it, just following the norms, it has gone through a transition of thought. It didn't always mean what it presently means. In fact, you're probably already familiar with other senses of the word culture. So it's in the Latin, there's the noun, which is cultus, and the verb is colo. As a noun, it had multiple, you go back into history far enough, back to the Greeks and the Romans and on into the Middle Ages, it usually meant for, you know, think of the words like cultivation of a garden or something like that. So it's the care for the labor of something. So in this case, you could talk about the land. You cultivate the land so that it produces vegetables and fruit and so forth. But it also was used to talk about cultivating the mind or the soul. So it was the training of the person to become a good person. So at some point, I'd like to be able to do a special session on ethics, and within this field of ethics, to talk about something that is completely absent from our discussion in world ethics anymore, and that's virtue ethics. In the classical understanding of ethics, what was important was you become a good person. You develop your mind, and you form habits, virtuous habits. And you avoided the development of vices. And when Christianity sort of came along and sort of adopted a lot of what we call the cardinal virtues and so forth like that, like justice and temperance and fortitude, and wisdom and stuff like that, prudence, it added to that sort of list the theological virtues of charity, hope, and faith. And so a transition happened within our Western culture, and now we don't think that way anymore. We think more about ends. We think more about achieving a certain level of happiness. And how is it that we achieve that level of happiness that makes us, you know, feel good? So utilitarianism is one of the philosophical ways of thinking, and is probably the predominant way of thinking in this day and age. There are other forms of thought, but that's probably the predominant one. So it's this, it's never about how you form the person anymore and become a good person. It's all about achieving ends by whatever means necessary sometimes. So cultivation. So you can, and then there's also this aspect, you could probably think of the cult of something. So a religious object or a religious form of reverence is also part of the word, Latin word. Also style of dress, appearance, and clothing. So, you know, it's once again, it's this idea of training, educating, you know, making something good, appeasing, whatever, whether it's your apparel, whether it's your mind, whether it's your garden in the backyard. That's the word cultivate is kind of behind all of those. Now, if you begin to use your imagination a little bit, you can extend this a little bit. So if we can cultivate our mind, then what are we doing about society itself? You can cultivate society, and that's kind of the development of your thought. Think of not so much virtues in that, but think of the product of your thought. And when you do that at a very large level within the community, then you have a culture. The cultivation of beliefs and values that undergird a society. That's a culture. So again, both the noun and the verb has all of these senses going on, but what we want to focus on is this modern notion of culture. Bring that up so you can see it. So the modern notion of culture is the collective development and inheritance of an intellectual achievement. And it doesn't have to be, you know, they talk about high society, low society, high civilization, primitive cultures and stuff like that. It doesn't matter whether you come from a, you know, what they call maybe a primitive culture or high society, whatever, it's a culture. If there are meanings and there are values, if there are human people, there's going to be a culture of some sort. And whatever you believe and however you value things, the products of that will also be considered part of the culture. The constructs that you make, the things, the art, the way you engage in recreation. Yeah, anything, almost anything that you do can fall within this overriding theme of culture. So, you know, it's very hard to define. But I think at its simplest level, we could define it as the meanings and values, practices and creations of a community of people. And you can talk about overriding cultures like Western culture, this really big phenomenon that takes into consideration what, you know, a billion or so people believe, or billions of people believe and value. Or you can talk about subcultures within that. You can talk about subcultures within the church. There's not just one culture. If you go, the way we practice our faith here in North America, go to Africa, go to Latin America, go to India, go to China. The way they practice their faith is going to reflect a very, you know, maybe not astronomically different, because we all hold the same biblical worldview, and we'll come to that notion of worldview. But that worldview, that biblical worldview, expresses itself in many different manifestations. And so we can talk about culture at large. We could talk about subcultures and sub-subcultures and so forth. There's no scientific way of pinning down, oh, that's a culture, and that's a culture, and that's not a culture. You know, it's there's a little bit of, you know, but you get the idea. when you have sort of different ways of doing things, different ways of thinking and practicing things, you know, and the relationship of their ideas and how they cohere with one another, you begin to see, you know, how the art reflects. There's a bit of a commonality within the art that's made, or there's a different commonality within what type of music they listen to or what type of games they play and so forth. You begin to see that is a culture. It's a very distinct culture from this other one. Now, I put up here for anybody who's interested, there's a Daniel Mahoney has written an article called Rescuing the Meaning of Culture, which is posted online on a website called The Imaginative Conservative. And he's going to take a little bit of a critical perspective of this contemporary meaning of culture, because there is something missing. There's something missing from our contemporary notion of culture, which neglects the older use of the meaning, which was the development of character. And so he would like to, so I throw that out there if you want to read it. It's not very long at all. And it's a very interesting one, and his concerns are going to be something that we feed that will be coming across as we move along. But it's a good one to read just to sort of remind yourselves that this contemporary notion of culture is very modern. You know, it's been around since maybe the 1800s or something like that. But when we talk about culture within the actual discipline of, like, say, something like anthropology, the anthropologist, when they're looking at culture, they're not looking at it from a evaluative perspective. They're looking at it, is this a good culture? Is this a bad culture? They're just looking at it to study it simply as a culture. And so there's good reason to just talk about culture simply, you know, not in this evaluative, it's is it good or is it bad? But there's, when we talk about it from our perspective, when we talk about engaging culture, there is something to what Daniel Mahoney is arguing, and that is that, do you really have a good, strong, developing culture if you neglect the cultivation of the person, the cultivation of the soul? You know, what is the purpose of your education system? Is it just to pump out people to get jobs? Or is it to make them truly good people? You know, develop the mind, develop the will, you know, develop your passion so that they respond properly to under given circumstances to moral situations. So anyways, I leave that to you for your own time of study. James W. Sayer, in his book, The Universe Next Door, A Basic Worldview Catalog, taken from the 6th edition, page 6, says this: a worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of propositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, that we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. So we're transitioning here now from the understanding of what a culture is, you know, a set of meanings and values. It will work its way out in the constructs that we make in our art and so forth, but a worldview, as he says, digs down to the very depths of what it is that you think, what you believe, and how you value things. So what's a way of thinking of this? It's a fundamental orientation of the heart. So think of when the Bible talks about the people of Israel, and it talks about them falling into sin, and it talks over and over again about the hardening of their hearts towards God. It's not just the emotional part of you. It's the deep core part of you. It's intellectual. It's volitional. There's something at the very, you know, you get down to the heart of it. It's kind of like a way of a figure of speech that we speak, and that's kind of like, that is kind of like getting down to the heart of what does that mean? Right at the very foundation of how you perceive reality is a worldview, whether you've thought about it or not. And some people would say it is the lens by which we understand the world. It is a perspective from which we understand the world. Nobody is without one. Sometimes we can step back. If you confront another person with a different worldview, you may not have heard of the word worldview before, but you begin to understand, he's challenging me on my belief that there is a God that exists who created the world, or that there is life beyond death, or that there is a problem in this world, and that problem stems from this thing called sin. And they have a different perspective, and they might say, there is no God. What there is just this pure, harsh, material reality. You are an accident that came into this world, and when you die, that's it. It's a complete cessation. In fact, the whole universe will one day burn out. So, opposed worldviews. Once they come into clash with each other, then you begin to say, okay, I'm starting to get down to where it is that my most fundamental beliefs come from. And if you have a Christian commitment, you've also got a set of values. How do you value your neighbor? How do you value your relationship with God? And so that has a very important impact on it. So all that kind of stuff. So it's another way of looking at this. So in logic or something like that, in philosophy, they will talk about first principles or key fundamental assumptions. So, or you could think of this in terms of math. 2 + 2 = 4, 1 + 1 = 2. Math, that's very basic, you know that. Then, let's pump it up. What about algebra? What about calculus? Algebra and calculus, what do? They presuppose the basics of math. You can't do algebra or calculus or physics unless you know 1 + 1 = 2 and 2 + 2 = 4 and 5 + 5 = 10 and 5 × 5 = 25. You can't do any of those. So when we're talking about a worldview, it's something like that. That even some of the most, what you might call trivial things, like my desire to sit on the lake and to reflect on, see the moon, glowing off the lake and just sort of being caught up in that moment, say, this is beautiful, and boy, is God wonderful and great. You probably wouldn't be sitting there doing that very thing if you just think it's just a bunch of physical atoms that are out there in some type of accidental relationship with one another, and that's, so it completely changes your perspective, but it changes your reality to extreme degree. So James Sire comes up with he lists 8 or so different questions, fundamental, what we call worldview questions. If you want to know what, underlies your worldview, these are certain, you ask the question, okay, what's your answer to this? Because if you dig down and you answer these questions, you begin to see that, okay, I do have a worldview. So here are his questions, and I've thrown in a couple of others which to add to the list. So what is prime reality? The really real. What is the really real? Is God part of that reality? Is the reality in which we live purely material? Is it purely spiritual? Is it a bit of both material and spiritual? What is the nature of external reality, the world around us? A very similar question. Again, what is a human being? So the Christian answer will probably say, well, he's a creature of God's making and made in the image of God and loved by God. Well, how will a Buddhist answer that question? How will a Hindu or a Muslim answer that question? What about a materialist? They'll have a different answer to that question. What is the problem with the world? Whether social problems or individual problems that we face. Is it I'm not getting enough pleasure? I'm experiencing too much pain. What is it? Am I not getting enough recognition? What is it? So a Christian will have a response. Well, we get right down to the heart of it, is that sin is a problem. Sin is the underlying problem that we experience in the world, and other viewpoints, world viewpoints, are going to have a different answer to that question, most likely. So, next one. What is the solution? So if there's a problem, then what's the solution to the problem? What is our purpose in life? What happens to us after we die? Why is it possible to know anything at all? Or can we know anything at all? How do we know what is right and what is wrong? What is the meaning of human history? Or is there any meaning to human history? What personal life-changing core commitments are consistent with this worldview? So all of these things, all these questions, if you were to ask these questions and you dig right down to the heart of it, that's your worldview. And that's how you see the world, and that's how you're going. Now, when we move on from here, we have the question of what is a biblical worldview. The biblical worldview is going to respond to each one of those questions. And the Bible presents either a very explicit answer to those questions, or at least a very implicit. I say explicit. So, what is it that makes humans unique, if anything? Well, you're made in the image of God. That's a very explicit answer. Can we know anything about reality? How can we know that we know that reality is the world that we think is out there really is? Well, you may not get a very explicit answer to that question, but you certainly get a very implicit answer to that question. And that, at least at the very least, that God is, because God has created us in his image, he's created us with the capacity to know the world, and that by knowing the world, we can also know him as creator. So, all heavens declare the glory of the Lord. So, there is that capacity that God has built, and we can trust that our knowledge capacities are at least somewhat capable, because we're at least attributed with that capacity to understand that God exists. So I'm just going to take a quick little break here. So I've given you sort of this general presentation of what culture is and what a worldview is. And so this is just maybe an opportunity just to make sure that everyone's sort of clear and understand, or if you're a little bit fuzzy, now's your opportunity to sort of say, okay, let's just back up a little bit. So is there anybody here who has any questions? And if you have any questions anyways, at whatever point in time, because this is being recorded, I'm going to sort of repeat your question, which is good for two things. One, for the people who will be or potentially listening to this, so they know what's being asked, but also so I can confirm that I'm actually understanding the question too. So are there any, at this point, are there any questions need for clarity, or is this just pretty, I got it. We're good to go. So, okay, I think we're good to go. So let's move on. So one of the issues, and this is for people like myself, coming from a philosophical background, this one thing just kind of jumps right out. So if you're seeing things from a perspective, does that not suggest? And you see things when we talk about seeing the world through this lens, which we call worldview. Is there not at least a small hint, if not a very explicit connotation of relativism? Now, who here knows what, anybody here who doesn't understand what the notion of relativism is? Okay, so let me explain what relativism is. Relativism is the notion that knowledge of something that exists, let's say, the world as it really is, can never be known. And the reason why it can never be known is because you can only make a claim from a perspective. And you can never get outside of that perspective to be able to make a judgment, an objective judgment, about whether that claim is true or not. So, for example, just a simple claim. The world exists. You exist. I'm not just making this up. Other minds exist besides my own. So believe it or not, these questions get debated within philosophical circles. You probably don't have to believe, but anyways, so these are legitimate questions. It's a question of, there's a sphere of philosophy called epistemology, which is basically just means theory of knowledge. How can you know that you know? And so it's more complicated than you might think. The common sense is, well, of course, I can just. There was one philosopher, sort of man of letters, who's responding to the question of, does the world exist? Well, he just kicked a rock. He said, there, it exists. That was his response. It's pretty common sense. I think it's Samuel Johnson. So here's the point. So if a Christian claims, let's say, for example, that external world, the physical world which we touch, feel, hear, and sense, exists. Then on the other hand, a Buddhist, let's say a Zen Buddhist, says there's appearance. It appears that the world concretely exists, but that's not the actual reality. Or Hinduism, forms of Hinduism, where your whole objective is to become one with Brahman, which is not the god of Christianity or anything like that. It's a pantheistic version of God. Everything is God. And so so suffering and stuff like that in the world, evil, good and evil, they're all our own, as it were, almost projections upon the world. But when we get down to the reality that you have to escape the self to become one with Brahman, and then all is one. There is no. So think of Star Wars, the force that exists, the good, the dark side, and the good side. It's all the same force, but it has a dark side and it has a good side. But it's all the same thing. It's one and the same thing. So what do you do when you have opposed perspectives? And so if the argument is if you can only argue from within your own perspective, how can you get outside of your perspective to judge the other perspective? That's relativism. So has anybody ever thought what might be a good response to this absolute claim that all knowledge is perspectival and therefore relative? There's no absolute truth. All there is are perspectives. Some of you have probably heard of postmodernism. Postmodernism is the philosophical school of thought, which was a reaction to what was earlier called modernism, which was very hopeful and very optimistic about what we could know. They thought, we could understand all of reality and we can do this through physics and so forth. Postmodernism, especially in light of the two world wars and so forth, takes this more nihilistic turn, this we can't know anything. And so relativism is something that pervades our society. So if you don't understand what relativism is, you better learn it and understand it. So relativism, as any good philosopher, anybody who takes the time to think about it, is actually self-contradictory. If relativism is true, then the relativist claim is itself derived from a perspective viewpoint and is therefore only true relative to its underlying viewpoint. So if you say relativism is true, you're not just making a relative claim, you're making an absolute truth claim. So if you're saying absolute truth cannot be known, only relative truth, then any claim you make under that claim is itself relative. So if I make an absolutist claim as a relativist that says that there's no such absolute thing as truth, well, what about that claim I just made? There's no such thing as absolute truth. By their own categories, it's relative. So it's contradictory. Postmoderns, when you understand postmodernism, they don't really care. Like I said, there's something else pervading the thinking of postmodernism that digs deeper than an intellectual issue. It goes right to the heart. Postmodernism is kind of a worldview. James Sire includes it as within his list of worldviews, and it's kind of like. Worldview is probably most closely akin to religion, because there's nothing closer to the very core of who you are what you believe and what you value, than your religion, if you take it seriously. If you take Christianity seriously, it's at the very core and center of your being, and it permeates every aspect of your life. A worldview is very much like that. It's very difficult to define what a religion is, but there are, we know for one thing, you can't define religion as belief in God, because there are religions that do not believe in God, Buddhism, for instance. Certainly, you can't claim that it's belief in a set of values, because everybody has a set of values. So how exactly do you define what a religion is? And when it comes right down to it, religion will encompass a worldview, but of course it has much more to it than simply just a worldview. A worldview, again, is a set of assumptions or a set of very core beliefs and values that undergird how it is that you engage, the world. So relativism is in itself self-contradictory. So the claim that everything is relative is certainly cannot be absolutely claimed to be true. That doesn't mean that there's not some validity to what's being said, however, because we do see things from a perspective. You cannot function. You come into this world and you use a language. And anybody who's studied multiple languages will know that there are certain concepts that just don't quite translate. And so certain cultures and backgrounds, with linguistic backgrounds, will have concepts of how they think of things which just don't translate very well into English. And it's very difficult to translate sometimes. And so you have to use metaphors and analogies to be able to communicate what that person is thinking and what they're trying to communicate to you. So it's latching on, the argument is latching on to something that has some truth to it, but to push it to the extreme and say that there's no such thing as absolute truth, that becomes problematic. It's just logically incoherent. So perspectivalism does not imply absolute relativism. Coming from a perspective does not negate our intellectual capacity to analyze, critique, and judge a truth claim. We have the capacity to critique even our own presuppositions. And here's the thing, cultures change. If we were just kind of stuck, and this is part of a critique of relativism, if everybody was simply stuck in these language games, if everybody was just stuck in this, you're formed by your culture, you're formed by your language, and you're just stuck in that and you can't break out of it, then there shouldn't be any such thing as development of culture. It should just keep repeating itself and repeating itself and repeating itself. But that doesn't happen. We know very well that new meanings and that we see things, we learn new things about the world around us all the time. New ideas are introduced all the time. That comes from a mind. So their minds must have some type of capacity to transcend even our cultures and our languages and so forth in a certain sense. By working through them, we can still, in a certain sense, transcend that and to come to truth. So we have a capacity to critique even our own presuppositions. Part of our focus will be to look at critiques of the biblical worldview and address them while looking at the strengths and weaknesses of alternative worldviews as well. And this is the important thing, is that while we're talking about engaging culture through a biblical worldview, we're also talking about, okay, when we engage culture, don't expect everybody to just kind of passively accept everything you're saying. Or everything that you're contributing to society, whatever it is, you're going to get pushback. And it's strange, it's funny how relativists, people from the postmodern tradition who aren't Christians and disavow any type of association with Christianity, they'll talk the big game about relativism, but when it comes to Christianity, oh, they'll attack it from multiple angles. So they don't actually they're not actually playing consistently with their own game. If you can't critique somebody, you can't critique somebody who's outside of your perspective. So that's one of the ways you can sort of help begin to identify the strength or weakness of a worldview if it's not internally coherent, if it's not consistent within itself. So if something is true, it's probably, if a set of claims are going to be true, those claims should be able to bear out and you should be able to live by them. So we've talked about in isolation the notion of culture, sort of a set of meanings and values that guide that are shared in common within a given society, however big or small that society will be. It could be a large culture at large, it could be a subculture within a larger culture. But now, and we've talked about worldviews, these very core, at the heart type of beliefs and values that you have that just you don't reflect upon most of the time, and if you do, you know, it's on those rare occasions where you're feeling like a Plato or an Aristotle, and you just think, oh boy, I need to philosophize right now. Which we all do, I'm sure. So anyways, we have time for that, don't we? Anyways, so now let's talk about the relationship between worldview and culture, which we've sort of engaged in. So what is the difference between a worldview and culture? A worldview underlies any given culture in a similar way that basic mathematics underlies and undergirds higher forms of mathematics and physical sciences, like algebra, calculus, physics, chemistry, and so forth. You cannot perform the higher forms of math without knowing and affirming basic math, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. In the same way, a culture is more expansive in terms of its meanings and values than a worldview, but all of its meanings and values are in some way dependent upon the products of one's worldview. Even if some cultural expressions are in some ways inconsistent with a worldview. So it's possible that you can be living a life somewhat in contradiction to your worldview. As Christians, we're very well aware of that. At the very heart of it, we may say Jesus is Lord, and he's the one who ought to be worshipped, but we're also built into our Christian faith is this recognition we're sinners. And that's a problem that's going to be lingering with us until Christ comes again, or until we leave this world, and at some point beyond that, we have resurrection bodies, and then we live with. So, we have this worldview which encompasses the recognition that we're not always going to be consistent, and every culture is like that. Every culture is going to have a worldview, an underlying worldview, and you will find parts of the culture which just don't always cohere with the underlying worldview, and that's part of what we've experienced here in the West, is that in sort of the history of Christendom, remember that Christianity in the West was largely unified up until the Protestant Reformation. Now, I say in the West because there was a split between the East and the West before the Reformation ever came along, but then you have this division. Same worldview, same answers to those worldview questions, but then there's something within, still sort of right at that core of the worldview, which begins to be questioned, and you have the split within through the Protestant Reformation, as seen as a corrective, and being more consistent with a Christian worldview or so forth, whatever, but. You have a development of cultures then, which begin to reflect sort of around the way Calvinists think, and the way the Lutherans think, and the way that the Anabaptists think, whether it's the Mennonite or whether it's the Amish, the way Catholics think. You have very distinct type cultures, and I can vouch for that. Like I said at the very beginning, that being within the Mennonite community circles is like they have a huge emphasis upon their community and protecting that community, which we do not. You know, and so culture and worldview are related to each other in this way that every culture is going to have a worldview, but every culture is going to somehow be an expression of that worldview. Down to the art, the way you play games, what you choose to play, the way you talk, the language, the music, everything. It's like everything is going to be somehow impacted or influenced by that worldview, but it will express itself in interesting in interesting ways. Now, the word engage. So what am I talking about when we're talking about engaging culture? So there's some variation, which I would like to suggest, in how we engage culture, and it depends on circumstances. Sometimes, this is kind of like Ecclesiastes, there's a time for this, there's a time for that. It varies. It can vary from a passive indifference, a different encounter with, or a withdrawal from, to an active involvement in. So a passive indifference, not everything in culture is either, could really fall under the notion of either obviously good or bad, you know. For example, should I drive a GM into work today, or should I drive a Ford into work today?
Amen.
So, well, I suppose there's some people to whom that digs right at the worldview, core of the worldview, but probably most people it doesn't. So there's a lot of things in culture which we can be indifferent towards. However, let's say, on the other hand, that you come from an environmentalist perspective. Do you drive in a battery-powered vehicle, or do you drive in your gas-guzzling, you know, Tonka truck? Whatever, I don't know. So your worldview is going to impact that. That's meaningful, but not everything is meaningful to everyone. So that's why there are some things in culture which we don't, you don't feel any obligation to affirm or to reject. You just kind of, whatever, okay. It's not that significant. And this notion of indifference, that's in Paul's letters too. Paul talks about there are things that we should just be indifferent to. It's not like you have to make a choice one way or the other. The other aspect, withdrawal from. We're going to get into this. One of the books that I'm going to suggest that we do read, I would encourage you to read. It came out a few years ago, and it's you've probably heard, some of you may have heard his name. His name's Roger here, and it's a book titled Live Not by Lies. The title of that, Live Not by Lies, actually comes from a Russian, a major Russian literary figure of the 20th century named Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I'll talk, but at some point we'll talk about his very important essay. But in some ways, Roger here is in his book, he's warning us about what is. He's a journalist, and he's looking at, he did a number of interviews with people who lived under the Iron Curtain. And these people, one by one, he would interview them. Do you see anything in this culture that makes you think of what you went through? And every one of them said, yes. What's happening now reminds me exactly of what happened in the lead up to the, or in the aftermath of the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe, or in the Soviet Union itself. It rings a bell with them because they went through it. And in his essay, Live Not by Lies, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, you may have heard the book, and if you haven't heard of it, you should know about it. He wrote a big, long tome called The Gulag Archipelago. It was written and published, he wrote it, about his own, because he was thrown into the gulags. The gulags are the prison camps in Russia, and so he was a prisoner. He was a prisoner. He served something like 8 years in the prison camps, and he saw it all. And when he had a conversion experience, he turned to converted to Christianity in the prison camps. And then when he came out, he started publishing materials, and he started writing about his experiences and the experience of others who endured the gulag. This is like thousands of pages long. It's a multi-tome book. And he published that in the West. And it was the awakening of the West, really what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, because we had no idea. We had no idea about the prison camps and the millions and millions of people who died under the Red Terror and under the Stalinist reign and reigns since then. But he wrote this essay called Live Not by Lies, which he published, which he sent out to his followers the very day that he was, or the day before he was arrested and exiled from Russia, where he moved to the United, where he moved eventually to the United States. And in that tome, he says, It's basically, to summarize it, is it's basically this. You may not be able, you may not have the courage to go out into the public square and to confront the Soviets to their faces. But at the very least, the one thing you can do is live not by lies. You do not participate in anything that you know is a lie. And he had a list of 7 or 8 different rules for his people, and we'll read them at some point, hopefully down the road, that if you, to live by not lies means this. You are a non-participant in the ongoing lies that the government is pushing upon you, and the journalists and so forth. And there are different ways and different avenues in which you can do that. So Roger Heer's book is in that same vein. And so when I say we're talking about withdrawal from, what we're talking about is, this is kind of last resort. There are times where you need to come together as a community and to set up a situation where you're almost like running a parallel lifestyle to a parallel economy, a parallel whatever. We're not at that point here in the West. But if Roger here is right, we're definitely heading in that direction. So sometimes engaging in culture can mean a withdrawal, while at the same time realizing I will not participate in the lies that are being told. But there's also this other part, and hopefully this is the one that we can work on and we can especially emphasize, and that is our active involvement in culture. And we're going to be talking just momentarily about different perspectives on how it is that how we engage culture as from very shortly, but I think as our calling, our mandate of the Great Commission, go into the world and make disciples of all men, we're pretty much mandated to influence our culture. There's no way you cannot obey that command and not be influencing your culture. For people to come to them with the message that Jesus is the good news, that Jesus is the answer to the problem that ails society's woes and gets to the very heart of your own problem individually. That is the problem of sin. He died, he rose, and he is Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, then who isn't Lord? It's not Caesar. It's not the President of the United States. It's not the Prime Minister of Canada. Who really is Lord and sovereign over this world? So it's going to make a big difference. So when you engage people with the gospel, you're engaging them at the very core of the culture, the cultural worldview itself. So you can't help but change the culture if you go right to the heart of it. So withdrawal from, so like I said, there are going to be tensions, and this has always and largely been the tension what we've experienced around the world. Like there have been consider the last 120 so years. You can take all the martyrs from the early church on down to the 20th century and add them all up, and that won't even come close to the number of martyrs who have died for the faith in the 20th and 21st century. So there are a lot of Christians who know all about this. But withdrawal from, so there's going to be tensions between culture and, predominant culture and one's faith. For example, whether it's the involvement in an unjust war or sexually deviant behavior and forms in which such behavior is celebrated and promoted, all of these things we see, we know very well where the lines should be drawn. And active involvement, if we're going to be actively involved, to what ends are we going to be actively involved? So recognition that certain aspects of culture are good or morally indifferent to one's worldview. So we have to be able to critique culture in order to know what are the parts that, we can be indifferent to, what are the parts that we can say, this is good and we should be able to promote this. Or on the other hand, we need to withdraw from this and not give our consent and not give our participation in. Our intention should ultimately be to inform and to redeem culture. Not that we're doing the redeeming, God's doing the redeeming, but the intention is to see the conversion or redemption of culture. Informing, to make a positive contribution to the surrounding culture. And that can come in many ways. Cultural involvement is, it could be just helping people who are poor, helping people who are in nursing homes or whatever. There are so many ways. Anytime you go out in the world and you make a positive contribution to the world, you are in your own way impacting culture, and you are engaging culture, and that can make a world of difference. To redeem is to recognize that not all aspects of one's culture is good, and to seek to correct and restore culture to what is good. And let me say this right off the bat. That does not mean that every correction has to be through, or every even should be through, political means. There are some people who think that if you can just change the president or the prime minister, everything will be fine. I think we've learned that that is a lie for the last several decades now at this point. Do not trust the political system to be able to work in any type of way that favors the gospel. So it does not mean to seek out confrontation as an enemy. So if we're not going out there to actively start a fight, then that should never, ever be one's intention. As Christians, we're called to go out in love and to present Christ's love to the world, and you don't do that in an angry, confrontational manner. That's simply not how it goes as a Christian. Confrontation may happen, and it may even at times be necessary, but it doesn't mean that you can do it with the very intention of just being angry for anger's sake. Okay. Now, anybody here have any questions or reflections, thoughts that have come up to this point? Gary, yes.
That is, be willing to take part in different committees, whatever, we would have a tremendous influence. Now, it seems that in our thinking that we withdraw and, let others do it, but I think that's where we should be proactive.
Yeah, and then just for recording purposes, I'll just kind of summarize, Gary, what you just said. And so that, in essence, is that as Christians, thinking with education system in mind, we should not be passive, but we should be active. We should be active participants, and if it means serving on an education board or whatever, just become involved in the public education system. And I know that this is probably one area that that a lot of Christians have perhaps thought more along the lines of withdrawing from, more so than anything. Like the numbers of people, and for different reasons too, COVID and stuff like that, people have withdrawn their children from the public education system to homeschool. And certainly homeschooling is good. If there's going to be a public education system and you want, and in and of itself, the public education system is a good of society. We need to be active, especially if you desire to put your children through the system, then you better be active. And so I'll just repeat that thought, is that a lot of, within certain jurisdictions at least, and maybe it's more universal than just certain jurisdictions, that you can't serve on an education board unless you actually have children within that particular system. So if people are, or grandparents are, let's say, for example, or they're childless, but they're very interested in the education of children, they can't just simply go and sit on boards. And so, you know, that throws a bit of a wrench, but like I say, the church is not just one or two people. Sometimes there are just one or two people doing all the drudge work, and that's unfortunate, but we need to be able to see ourselves within the culture at large, having a positive influence, and if God lays upon you the desire to see fit that children are raised and educated in a manner that is, you know, befitting of our Christian values, then your involvement will be necessary at some point, probably. Yeah, and Uncle Doug?
In regards to being involved in the public school, a lot of Christian people back away from it, such as I did when I was asked, I was given the privilege of being involved in this public school. But if I introduced prayer, automatically discontinued. You can't bring anything in regards to your Christian walk. You can't bring any of that in to the sound of children listening. So that's one reason why you'll find a lot of Christians or even nominal Christians, they don't get involved because of situation.
And you're saying this is a Christian school system?
No.
Or just the public school? Okay, yeah. That makes more sense. So yeah, and so the idea here is that if you were to go into a public school system, to you know, volunteering your services to contribute to, you know, the education system in some capacity, and of course, prayer is not allowed and stuff like that, prayer for the children or whatever, you know, that's a roadblock. You know, there's a question where can you still make a contribution even if you can't make one in that, you know, so overtly, you know, through prayer or something, expressly. There are ways probably you can still make a contribution. And the question is that are you willing to, you know, in a less obvious way, influence the direction of a school board, or let's say, because if Christians don't do it, then you've given all the area of persuasion over to everyone else. So, and this is yeah, and there's another question. Yes.
And as parents, if you still have children in school, getting involved in the parent support groups and that gives you a little bit of a foot in the door with the Board of Education when things aren't right, that you can go to them and complain and make changes for changes, but you have to look from within.
So there we go. And that's, and so the thought there is that even if you can't, like, do sort of the more explicit Christian ways of, you know, influencing in obviously for a positive way, like through, you know, prayer and stuff like that, you know, public prayer, you can still participate and still have an influence even through less overt means. And you can still have persuasive power. And so, like, even just going in there and helping a child to learn, and you're not throwing pornography in their face. That's a real case today. And so that is important, because you're saving that child from that, that menace to society. Yes?
Wayne, you were saying that to engage culture, we ought to not go in looking for a fight, but you best be ready for one.
Yes.
Because if you see what's going on around us now, those that are on the cultural side that we don't support and we don't believe in, they are ready for a fight. And it takes very little to light them off like a Roman candle. They just go off, almost violently now. So I'm just saying, if you're going to push back, you best be aware that you're going to get some major consequences when you push back on any, particularly any of these, what I'm going to call the perversion that's being pushed on our culture and on our children and our society today. If you speak out against any of those, you best be ready for a fight.
Yeah. So the comment there is that you may not be going into, engaging culture with ever the intention of, starting a fight or anything like that, which would be an unchristian intention to begin with, but do not expect not to be confronted with a certain vociferousness and hate, because you will. Because we live in our culture is quickly becoming anti-Christian. That's part of why I'm sort of wanting us to do this, because what we think is bad now is getting worse, and it's not going to get better. So let's think about it now.
Doesn't the Lord tell us to win with love in our hearts and not with the sword?
Exactly. Yes. So we need to, above all things, be Christ-like. He endured the cross and bore its shame, and he didn't do that fighting back as the zealots wanted him to do or anything like that. He didn't start a war. He could have, but he didn't.
You're ready to weave your whip.
So, yeah. So anyways, it'd be interesting to do a poll, and maybe 2 weeks from now we'll do it for those who are able to be here, or to do a poll and say what cultural issue, or maybe what are the top three cultural issues that impact you and impact your thinking the most? Is it education? Is it certain policies being pushed upon us, whether it's certain environmental policies or what? Just think about that. If you were to sort of list, what are my top three concerns about the trajectory which culture is on, what would they be? And, that actually would be good information for me, because as I'm developing thoughts, and if we're continuing on for a while with this, then we need to address that. And so let's, maybe 2 weeks from now, we'll consider maybe doing a bit of a poll just to see what people are thinking and what sort of is generating the most concern within your own household. Yes?
Would there also be suggestions of how to make a difference?
Yep.
How to get involved with a confrontation? But
yes, so that's
at home watching whatever on TV is not going to change any of these things that are bothering you.
No. So we're going to... So the question was, are there going to be practical suggestions on how it is that we engage culture in a peaceful, Christ-like way? And so that's, and here's where I don't have all the answers, and here's where we need to be able to share with one another, because you all have different life experiences than I do. And so some of you have already engaged and confronted and been confronted in situations. And maybe you you had some small victory as a result of that confrontation, or maybe it threw you off a little bit, whatever. But we need to be able to sort of think through those things. So we're going to go on now, and we'll pick up with more discussion later. Christ and Culture, there was a book, a very popular book that gets used still in colleges and seminaries today, written by a Christian reform from the Reformed tradition, American theologian named Richard Niebuhr. It was called Christ and Culture. And he presented in that book, he presents in that book five models of Christian response to culture. And these are basically, he divides them more or less along certain denominational lines. I would just suggest that these are more ideal types. I think there would be people from certain denominational backgrounds who might challenge some of his ideal types and how he sort of associates them with them. But maybe rather than, we'll talk about this, five different ways, and this is just kind of food for thought. And I myself am still sort of thinking through, okay, what do I like about some of these perspectives? But it's kind of, I think this is kind of a helpful way to stimulate the way we can think about engaging culture. So the first one, Christ against culture. Here, Niebuhr associates us with the Anabaptist tradition. So here, and again, I would not say that all Anabaptists would agree with this categorization of them, but anyways, let's just take this as sort of an ideal type, one extreme. And here we have two extremes and three middle positions. So one extreme, and this one extreme is Christ against culture. We should have allegiance to Christ only and not to culture. So this is the withdrawal from culture. You have your own little culture. You do not participate. You do not participate to a large extent. There's no such thing as no participation in culture. It's just like, we live around the Amish, and we know very well that they're probably what you would call the more culturally defensive within the, sort of the Christians in this neck of the woods. They prize their culture extremely, and that's a good point. And we need to do that more ourselves. But you know, they don't drive. They don't drive mechanical machinery, but. They have no problem, but they realize the challenges of getting by simply with horse and buggy. You can't just ride your horse and buggy up to Toronto, and so forth. So there's no such thing as non-engagement, and the very fact that they're in this community at all impacts the culture of this area too. So I think that's, you know, I personally value that. Like, I work with an Amish gentleman at work, and you know, I value his presence and his community's presence in our area. They certainly contribute something very important, and there's a lot that we can learn from them. And so anyways, allegiance to Christ. So this is, let's say this is the most extreme perspective, just total withdrawal, and you know, let the culture be itself. We do not have anything to do with the world. We will live in our own community setting, we'll have our own Christian culture, say so. The very opposite extreme, Christ for culture. This is associated with the liberal Protestantism, which is basically a largely conforming to culture. There's basically no conflict between Christ and culture. You can confess Christ while at the same time accepting everything that culture promotes. Culture is progressive. Christianity is progressive. Culture doesn't believe in miracles. We don't have to believe in miracles. We can demythologize the Bible. Therefore, Christ was just a human. We don't have to believe that he was divine. We can use the language, and it has metaphorical meaning and stuff like that, but it doesn't have real meaning. So that would be sort of the opposite extreme, where culture and Christianity are so fused together, it's hard to distinguish the two from each other. Now we have these three middle positions. First of which we can call Christ above culture, which gets associated with the Roman Catholic Church, and it's called the synthesizing model. So in here, there's not this negative, culture's bad, and the other position, culture's all good. There's this, all three of these positions are going to say there's good and there's bad. And there's a certain type of discernment that you need to go through in along the way. He calls this the synthesizing model. Christ raises culture to a higher goal. So grace does not destroy nature or culture, but perfects it and raises it to a state above its natural capacity. So let me try to think about this. So I use the word nature in there. If you're familiar at all with sort of, you're probably not familiar with medieval philosophy and theology, but in that medieval philosophy and theology, especially in the Middle Ages, sort of the key figure, or at least the most recognizable figure, would be Thomas Aquinas. And so when he talked about, and we think along these terms, the distinction between what's natural versus what's supernatural. A miracle, that's supernatural. It's above nature. So grace is above our nature. It does not destroy our nature. So when God saves us and he gives us grace, that grace, along with the theological virtues that form us, does not destroy our nature. So your intellect is good. At the natural level, your intellect is good. Your will may be deformed by sin, but in and of itself, it is still good. It's still created by God, and you are still created in his image. You are deprived or depraved, but you're not functioning completely right, but still, you could still cognitively think. You can still add 2 plus 2 and get 4, and you're not trying to go 2 plus 2 equals 15, 2 plus 2 equals, you know, you can still think. You haven't lost some capacity. You may your will is distorted, but you can still think. Grace does not destroy. So if you take this and you think of, well, what are the products of intelligence and volition and stuff like that? Well, culture is. The culture is the product of our thinking. It's a human product. And so if culture is a product of our thinking, it's going to have its distortions in it because our will is fallen, but it still has some good in it. So you're going to find a lot of people in the Roman Catholic circles who are philosophers, scientists, anthropologists, sociologists, and so forth, because they see value in those disciplines. They're good. You can participate in those. There's not a withdrawal from them, but there's not this total acceptance of them, simply as that. So grace is going to perfect. So the church, so they have their own ecclesiology, and we won't get into that, but you can still, through the teachings of the church and so forth, you can still bring, raise up society through God's, as God uses his grace, you can still, and if you follow the teachings of the church, you can still, culture can be raised up to a new level. And so it's a bit of an analogy, so think upwards. This dynamic upwards, something above nature, something above and better than what you're getting. It's teleological. There's culture, just like nature, has a higher end that's just beyond natural ends. It's not just that we're here to live this life and die. It's a supernatural end. Our final unity is with God, to be united with God. So too, culture can have a supernatural, can be transformed such that it also has a supernatural end, as it were. So that's the Roman Catholic middle position. There's also what's called the Christ in paradox with culture position, which is associated with Luther, Martin Luther, and the Lutherans. So this is called, Niebuhr calls this the dualism model. Corrupt culture versus Christ. We live in an unresolved conflict or tension between God and his righteousness and man and his righteousness, between God's grace and human sin, with one foot in culture and another foot in the kingdom of God. All culture is fallen and corrupt through and through. We have no choice but to live in it as a sinner justified by God's grace. So I'm going to just, I'll write this down over here on the on the blackboard. It's just simply, so we talk about our worldview. We can talk about creation. We can talk about sin or fall. And we could talk about redemption. The Lutheran perspective is what Niebuhr's saying, puts all the emphasis on this. When you talk about culture, we're so deprived or so depraved that whether it's the church, whether it's culture at large, everything is corrupt and fallen. And the only reason why it's redeemable is because of God's grace. So, but the fact is this is what we live in. You live in a paradox position. And so, how do you live? Well, you just be thankful for God's grace. So there's not much there other than, good luck. it's now, once again, this is maybe a caricature. I'm not saying that this is, completely consistent with how a Lutheran will think. But you can sort of see how if you put all your emphasis upon the notion of sin and the fall, and the only thing you have going for you is great God's grace and forgiveness, then you're living in this world where you just have to live with the tension. There's no positive view of culture itself because it's corrupt, it's fallen. And you just hope that by God's grace he reaches to it, but once again, even as Christians, we're fallen too. And so we're just ultimately just thankful for God's forgiveness. Now finally, we have what he calls the Christ transforming view. And this is, he associates with St. Augustine and the Reformed tradition following John Calvin. So or the Presbyterians would also be from that tradition. He calls this the conversionist model. So here, the conversion of culture from its sinful corruption, the conversion is what's the goal of culture from its sinful corruption to the kingdom of God. Good creation, the creation is good. It's followed by the corruption of the fall, but then that in turn is followed by redemption, and which must be viewed on all these things, must be viewed on an equal plane. The good of creation, the fall which corrupts us and our hearts, and also redemption. So if culture is the product of human, the way we think, the way we desire things and value things, then God's redemption, as it transforms us, can also and should transform culture. And so, so the created order, including culture, can be redeemed. St. Augustine, in his book, The City of God, basically presents, it's this huge, huge book, 1,000 pages or so, something like 1,200 pages. It was written at the fall of the Roman Empire. Rome was falling to the barbarians, and all of a sudden the pagans started complaining and criticizing the Christians, saying, see, you brought this upon us. It was your fault. We turned away from our gods, and see what your God did? It gave us over to these barbarians. So he wrote this book in response. Huge book, but essentially it's called The City of God, and it basically says there's the city of God and there's the city of man. And the city of God has basically been overtaking, and is overtaking through Christ, and those who follow him in faith is overtaking the city of man. They're essentially redeeming the culture. There's a passage in it, I believe it's at the very beginning, where he draws on this analogy of the Israelites before they come out of Egypt. They're collecting gold and goods, all and stuff like that, from the Egyptians. And Augustine's saying is, there's good in this world, and we're just redeeming it back to God, just like the Israelites were doing. They were taking those things that were given to the Egyptians, and they were turning them over to God in His service. So, anyways, I don't necessarily say you have to read The City of God because it's a really big book, but if you can, you got one up on me. I've read partially through it, but I can't. Don't seem to have the time to read through it all. So anyways, these are five different views. Yeah.
How did
What time is it? Hour and a half-ish, hopefully. What time is it? We're over time? Okay, we'll speed through the last bit. In fact, we can probably speed through. We all know certain passages, Romans 12. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may be able to discern what the will of God is, what is perfect and acceptable, good, acceptable, and perfect. You know, that's part of our call, is to be transformed by God, and then God's will carry on from there. Acts 17, 16 through 34, Paul's discourses in Athens. Paul is there, sort of taking from the Athenians, you know, you've got this altar to the unknown God. Well, let me tell you about that unknown God. And he's quoting from some poets, from pagan poets, and saying, even your own poets say this. And so Paul's not down on the culture, everything and every aspect in culture. He's saying, you have these pointers, which is pointing to the truth. You still don't know the full truth, but let me take it from there. Let me tell you what this altar is really pointing towards. Let me tell you what your poets, even though they didn't realize it, what they were thinking of and what their thoughts were oriented towards. And so there's this part where I think a couple of those perspectives that we just talked about sort of say, not everything in culture is bad. And it's being able to discern what is the good and from the bad, and use the good. Use the good to its full advantage. Well, at the same time, we have the warning from 1 Corinthians. Who is there? Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. So there's also this warning. Don't just latch on to everything and accept everything in the culture as true. As the one type, which the second one, the sort of the one associated with the Protestant liberal perspective, say, not everything in culture is good. And there's a certain wisdom that only God had that this culture could never discern apart from God's revelation. And of course, Revelation chapter 21, by this light, you know, Christ is the light in the New Jerusalem that comes down in the book of chapter 21. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. Parts of culture will be redeemed, and they will be present there in the New Jerusalem. So think about that. I'll skip through that. So we can continue this question. We'll continue this on into next week, and we'll talk about a little bit about culture. We'll get into what is a biblical worldview, and we'll also talk about some of the undercurrents of the cultural changes that we've experienced. And I'll also show you a short video from Roger here, and we'll go from there. But so we'll just close with any questions, comments, or anything like that that anyone would like to share, and then we'll finish off with prayer. So anybody have anything they would like to share, or any questions that come to mind? Oh, yes.
You're mentioning the unknown God that was in Corinthians?
Yes. Book of Acts. Book of Acts, yeah.
Okay. My understanding, is that not something that Plato came up with?
I know
that comes up, and everybody says you've got to be ambassador to God, and then maybe Paul used the unknown God as a venue to talk to the rest of the Greeks about that.
Yeah, so the question is whether in Paul's speech to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17, where he talks about the altar to the unknown God, is there something in Plato that associates with it? I can only say I'm not sure that there is. Plato, in most of his works, is more concerned about talking about the forms than he is about talking about the gods, because even in his book, the Timaeus, he talks about a craftsman God who creates the world based on the forms, but it's just, it's not the transcendent Christian God. But there's something that, you know, there's a closeness. In fact, a lot of Christians jumped onto that, and they love the Timaeus.
Well, that's why also, who's that guy? He's a Catholic.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
Thomas
Aquinas. Okay, well, so there's a Thomas Aquinas was more. Thomas Aquinas was more Aristotelian than he was Platonist. But there's a Platonist element in Thomas Aquinas. So I'll just be very brief. In Plato's Timaeus. The God who creates the world is identified as a craftsman. He calls the demiurge. That simply means, and like I said, for Plato, the forms are ultimate reality. The forms are eternal, universal. The gods, they may be immortal, but they're not the ultimate reality. What Christians did, they were influenced by Plato, and they said, the forms do not exist outside, independent of God. They're actually ideas in the mind of God. What's eternal are God's own ideas and God's wisdom, not the ideas, existing abstract objects existing out there in this nebulous celestial sphere. So that's where the Christians, and so Thomas Aquinas has a notion which is called exemplary causation, which is that God creates the world, or he even creates the order of the world in accordance with his wisdom, the ideas in his mind. So there's that Platon influence there, I suppose. But even before Christians were influenced, Philo of Alexandria, who was a Jew of the first century, was a middle Platonist, what's known as a middle Platonist, sort of a development of Platonism, and he had the same idea. So Christians are actually following in the wake of actually a Jewish thinker in that regard. So any other questions? So next week, we'll continue on with this discussion, and we'll just close in prayer, and should we also, yeah?
Is it next week or 2 weeks?
2 weeks, sorry, 2 weeks from now. Yeah, and so, yeah, so we got some snacks back there, so let's just close in prayer, and then a little bit of freedom to all of you. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together. Lord, you know the challenges that we face in this world, but nothing is outside of your sovereignty, and Father, we just give you thanks that you are with us, you guide us and protect us, and you're even moving with us to help us and assist us in this time. And we just pray that however far these discussions go, that, Lord, you will bless them and equip us for the ministry you've called us to this world, and help us to engage culture with a Christ-likeness that reflects your glory. And may all praise and glory be given unto you. In Jesus' name we pray.